I've always been struck over the years, perhaps it's because of the background I come from, which was really not in a church, with the how so many of the biblical words and the theological words we use don't really communicate to us anymore, at least to a lot of people. I find that true in teaching. And as I reflect on my own experience as a child, I can remember being in church sometimes. We weren't regular churchgoers in our family, but we went on the Easter and Christmas business, and listening to these sermons and having, I don't know, you probably have all had that experience at one time or another, that you don't know what in the blazes the minister is talking about as he speaks. And that, for me at least, I don't know how long that lasted for you. Perhaps, I don't know, John, you were brought up in an ecclesiastical family, and somebody, I don't know about you two, but I wasn't. And that lasted a long time for me through college. In fact, into seminary, aged 26 in seminary, still had not made much understanding of these words, which sounded like ecclesiastical jargon to me, as I think they do to most people. Somewhere along the way in seminary, I came to some sort of realization that the words, when I found out what they meant or what they were pointing to, actually were pointing to something in my experience. And what had happened to me, as I think it's happened to many people, is that we've had the words on one side, in fact, sometimes have used them, and we've had our own experience of things that are meaningful and purposeful on the other, and between these two kind of lives we live never meet, and so that the words have lost a kind of meaning. They no longer point to the experiences which they are meant to point to. Now, a few words on why I think this has happened, and then what I want to do is to explore, look at three theses about what religious language is all about, and then to look at a passage from the Gospel according to John, the famous, you're all familiar with, the foot washing, and try to use that as a basis for exploring what theological language can mean. I was assuming a little larger crowd, and I was going to split us up into groups and try to take some words and actually run some little skits on them. But with five, I think I'll recycle that plan and try something else on Wednesday besides that, because I'm not sure that it would be appropriate at this point. But we'll check that out later. Okay, why is it that these words don't communicate? Why is it the religious language, on the one hand, it seems to be talking about another world in our own daily lives we live in, a kind of up and down periods? Well, first of all, I think it has to do with clerical jargon. I just want to say clerical jargon. I think that's enough to communicate. Like any field, each field has its jargon, and the clerics are not immune to this disease. It's also, it seems to me, that certain words have been misused by certain groups. For example, the word repentance. When I hear the word repentance, I have this conjure up this image of a fundamentalist preacher thumping the pulpit, telling me that I'm evil, and that if I don't do it his way, that I will remain evil and not get to heaven. You know, all those images, that the words have been misused by certain people who I feel don't understand what they mean. Third, it's the words become time-worn. We've used them, and in some respects, they become cliches. But it seems to me the really big reason, and this, it seems to me, is fundamental to this whole thing, is that we have changed the way we think. We've had, in the West, the scientific technological revolution and the whole rational scientific way of thinking which has gone along with that. The New Testament writers thought, as Rudolf Bultmann said, in three-story terms: heaven, earth, and hell. Today in our thinking, in our everyday thinking, we may still use that imagery of the heaven, earth, and hell three-story, but in our everyday lives, we've really, for all intents and purposes, reduced the three stories to one. We see ourselves living on this earth and all things basically pertaining to it. We have these otherworldly images, but in our daily lives, they usually don't mean a whole lot to it. This shift of thinking has pushed us to seek sense, proofs of things. Some of the biblical language seems rather magical and talking about things which are unreal because you can't prove them or something like that. But this whole, what I'm doing here is just pointing to this whole fundamental shift of thinking that has occurred in the West, and so that the biblical language and much of the theology of the church is done in that other way of thinking, and here we are in this way of thinking, and trying to put those two together is like mixing oranges and apples sometimes. I think that can be done, but we have to get back down to what the words are pointing to in terms of experience. I don't propose here to solve this problem, but I would like to suggest that maybe if we start reconceiving the terms, the theological terms, in our own experience, that again they will become alive for us. So, let me pause here. What I've said, I think, is probably pretty clear. It's pretty straightforward. Okay. I want to... Three theses about theological language, God talk, I'm going to call it, as John Macquarie, an Episcopal theologian, calls it. He had a delightful book on God talk. And he's one of his great efforts has been to try to take the language, a jargon term like theology, and get it down into something that's talk about God, God talk. Three theses about God talk. And this includes biblical God talk. That's what relinks us and makes this a biblical study. Biblical God talk is of the same nature. And these are three rather obvious theses, but if you take them seriously, they're rather controversial in modern-day Christianity. First of all, God talk is human talk. You would think that that would be self-evident, but some people, I think, confuse theology or the theologizing or even the words of the New Testament with God's own talk. It seems to me that God talk is very human. The people who write the books and do the theologizing are people who suffer from the same problems and limitations that you and I suffer from, that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John weren't particularly different than us. They had powers of insight, deep powers of insight, but I think that that is probably a fairly constant thing throughout the history of the ages. It just in some periods gets expressed a little bit more clearly than in others. Now that's the controversial thesis, because many people think that God talk is God's talk, particularly in the Bible. They're a little bit, they understand that later theologizing is human talk, and is hence controversial, though some people take the Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed as kind of the literalness of what Christianity is. But what this does, if we see God talk as human talk, including the Bible, then I think it kind of de-deifies it. It de-divinizes, and we can understand that human beings talk that, and what human beings made, they can unmake. And that is to say, no theology, even the biblical theology, stands as an unchangeable, fixed kind of entity which later generations cannot alter given the needs of their time. I want to get back to the need to keep going back to that, but for the time being, I want to suggest, and I don't think, given what I see here in this crowd, there's probably much controversy at this point. Go ahead.
So you acknowledge that it is controversial.
Yes, it is, of course.
The hymn, "Time makes ancient truth uncouth," did not make the Lutheran hymnal.
Is that right?
Because the committee said that means that we're saying truth changes or that...
Well, what we might want to get into the question, does truth change? And it seems to me that there are eternal aspects of truth that we may want to explore. But I would, and I think probably most of you would agree, I don't know how this stands, that the language of the faith is not one of those things that's unchanging. It's pointer words. Okay, so theology or God talk is human talk. The second thesis is that God talk is our response to, not just ours, but human response to what is experienced as meaningful and purposeful, that is full of purpose and has meaning for us. So that we in our time experience things, and we have a different conceptuality, so we express it differently. The biblical writers in their time had a certain conceptuality, and they express their experience, in this case of the Bible, of the work of God in Jesus Christ in their own terms. Now this leads to both commonalities and differences. The differences, of course, occur because we're using considerably different conceptual schemes sometimes. The three-story versus one-story scheme that I was talking about. On the other hand, the thing that makes the biblical language, gives it the possibility of being meaningful to us, is that there seems to be a commonality of human experiences. That is to say, they experience death, we experience death. They experience love, we experience love. So there is some commonality, but that commonality can never be one-for-one exchange because of the changes that have occurred over the centuries in our way of thinking. So we do have a link. We can talk to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and other, but we have to be very careful about our dialogue because we may assume that they're speaking with the same kind of glasses on, with the same tint. They're wearing glasses, but theirs is orange and ours is are green. And so we have glasses, but they have different tints to them. So God talk, and this is the thesis, is that is the commonality is that both they and us are talking about what we have perceived through our limited capacities to perceive to be meaningful and full of purpose. And that leads to the third thesis, is that there, for God talk, there are, I would say, two bases of authority. And we use that word authority in religious language. Basically, it means sources of testing. Like, what do you test your experience against? What do you test the language against? And it seems to me that in our theology, we should have two primary sources. There may be a bunch of other sources, but two primary sources. One is our own experience. And I say that with some trepidation because I can hear some people say, aha, but you don't recognize that human experience is full of sin. Well, I recognize that fact, but I can't get over the other fact that there's no way of avoiding human experience as a filter for what is meaningful and purposeful. Even if we said that the biblical writers themselves filtered perfectly, we still have to filter what was filtered to them. And so that any kind of God talk or human experience still must be filtered through our own experience, our own modes of interpretation. And I don't see any way of getting around that, no matter how limited it is. And I would go further to say is that given the fact that, you know, man, human beings are made in the image of God, and that the possibility of redemption is made restored in the person of Jesus Christ, that's what the tradition says at least, that indeed that at certain times we do a pretty good job of filtering what is what we consider to be the work of God or what is meaningful and purposeful. So on the one hand, authority is our own experience. On the other hand, the authority, it seems to me, in the church is the biblical and the traditional materials of the church. I don't want to throw that out. For one reason, I don't want to throw it out, because our own experience is limited, and we have this fund of, like money in the bank, of historical wisdom, of people through centuries and centuries of time trying to figure out what this funny thing that we're engaged in is all about. I mean, that's quite a process if you really get into the processes of knowing and things like that. Knowing what the truth is very, very precarious. And we have this fund of wisdom. Second reason we say that the biblical theological traditional material is authoritative or a source of testing is because we are a community of people which affirms that. Now, this is no proof or anything like that, but the thing that hangs us together, the glue in a sense, is a common book. Whether that book is right or wrong, it is in fact the thing that hangs the community or glues the community together. And there is some truth in the fellowship of a community. And whether or not it has as its source of fellowship that some sort of truth, in a big sense of the word truth, it still is its source of authority. And so that is our source of authority, and we claim it as such, and consequently it seems to me we have, if we want to be Christians, we have to recognize it. The third reason is that I really fundamentally believe that whatever God is all about, and I'm not quite sure what, see, the word God itself is a pointer word. What does the word God point to? Well, that's what I want to get into, one of the things. But the word God itself is not, the names of God, we could call them El Shaddai or Yahweh or Deus or Theos, all these words point, it's not the word, but what's behind the word is important. And so finally, the Bible and the traditional materials are important because Theos, the word God and the other theological words really are pointing to something which I think has some fundamental truth for us. Okay, so two sources of authority. Then the three theses to the reviews, that God talk is human talk, number one. It's response to our experience and the experience of people through the ages to what is meaningful and purposeful. And finally, the two sources of authority for God talk are our own experience and the biblical traditional materials. And that includes the language of that materials. And so the task is trying to link up that material insofar as it's foreign to us to what we experience as meaningful and true in our day. Now let me pause here and see. I've gone pretty quickly through those, but I think those are pretty simple theses, and I think the problem's laid out now. And so before we get into any further, let me see if there's any questions. Or disagreement. Come on, Mary, you always have. I always count on Mary for a little disagreement.
Mary, sit over here.
No, I like it.
I think I understand. The second point is the hardest for me to go back and recall. So maybe if you do that once more. God talk is human talk. That one I got clear. The two sources, got that clear. Just say the second one once more.
God talk is our response and the response of people in ages past to what they perceive, feel is meaningful and full of purpose. What? And theirs.
And theirs.
Yeah. There are certain things that are very the center of our lives. What is Tillich's word, ultimate concern? Okay. It is our response and the response of the ancients to what concerns us ultimately.
Yeah.
Okay. That was point two, though.
That's point two.
Correct. Okay. That's what it's talk about. Because I wanted to say
that's the commonality. The different colored glasses are that we have our own filters depending upon the age, but the commonality is that
all God talk is of this nature.
Okay, all right.
And again, it differs between different cultures. Indians, Chinese have different perceptive schemes. That does not face the problem of what is the true scheme of things, but we may not be able to come to any conclusions at that line along those lines.
I guess the only kind of argument I want to raise with that is, why should God talk always be the heavy, the ultimate concern? I'll just be the devil's advocate. Why not say God talk is our best humor in any age?
Well, obviously, there's been some talk here, God talk about humor. I don't know, Mary and I have been dialoguing a little bit about it. Yeah, I would say humor is one of those elements that we find very meaningful and purposeful for various reasons. One of the things that happens to you in, let me just connect this up with the very interesting theological words of cross and resurrection. We experience the cross of Jesus Christ and the resurrection of Jesus Christ only when we are outside of ourselves, so just not focusing in on ourselves. When we focus in on ourselves and are unable to receive that which is outside of us, and the cross of Jesus Christ, to feel the suffering of that event, when we're close to the suffering of that event then becomes a thing, not something that we are participating in. It's an object outside of us. When the word cross is pointing to the suffering of a person, which we, for that to be meaningful to us, we have to feel. And when we're close to that, we are unable to do that. Now, humor has a interesting some characteristics which are very similar to that. That is to say, when you're laughing, if you think about the experience of human laughter, you really, to be able to laugh, you cannot be focused in and forced in on yourself. You really have to be receiving the humor which comes from outside, which breaks into your humor. Is like any kind of creativity. You're on a plane, and what's humorous comes in from another plane and intersects that. And to be able to laugh, you really have to be able to see and to receive and to participate in that intersection. And so you're fundamentally outside of yourself. There's an expression that has been had some meaning for me in this regard. You're most yourself when you're least yourself. And that, it seems to me, gets back to the Christian understanding that you are most whole when you're least centered in on yourself, and when you're suffering with another, or loving another, or, I would think, laughing with another is another characteristic of that. So I would suggest to you that laughter is very fundamentally an ultimate concern.
But if I heard your question, why? My experience has been that, and I'm not speaking of Holden Village, my experience has been that the organized church puts on this heavy trip of sin, and every bit of heaviness, rather than the church experiencing as a whole joy. So that I have found that for me the most Christ-like and biblical meaning of life really is outside the church, like at a Holden Village or like at other places.
But this is hardly outside the church.
Oh yes, this is, and it may be.
What's the word church mean? What is? So that's a theological word. It's God talk. What's church mean?
Well, I don't really want to get into a debate with you.
No, no, no. Seriously, this is
the
fundamentally what I
mean.
Okay,
is my
the
that's
all about ones.
And so I'm saying the organized me's don't speak for me.
Okay, but there's one word.
For me, outside the organized church.
The word church then has become a word which, to you, no longer points to what it originally was meant to point to, which was the group of organized me's.
I'm not sure that Jesus ever came to have an organized church.
Oh, I think you're entirely right. See, there's a good example of one of my points is that the word church has got this heavy otherness to us. It doesn't link up to what we really feel in a group of organized means that are sharing and caring, which is really the essence of the word church.
And I'm not even sure the organized church is caring and sharing.
Oh, well, some places it is, some places it
yes,
isn't.
Yes, that's right.
It's always a mixed phenomenon because the church, like the theology, is human beings, and they're mixed up in what's...
I know the individuals of the church, and since I think the church is me, I know individuals are caring and sharing.
But the
I
word,
was only responding
yeah,
to your...
Let me try it again then. I guess what I want the second premise to do, the first one I understand, is God talk is human talk. Third one is the sources, the two sources of God talk. What is the second premise meant to do? Is it meant to describe what kind of talk qualifies or is described by the phrase God talk? Is it meant to separate some talk is God talk and some talk isn't God talk? What's the...
I would say that would be part of it. My real intention there was to link the language that we take sometimes as church to pointing to our everyday experience of what is meaningful and purposeful.
Okay, alright.
That link has been lost, or one of the problems for many people. I think a lot of people have that link still intact. But that was the problem for me, I know, and I usually find when I have a problem that I'm not alone in that category, that I, like a lot of other people, is that link between experience and the talk, between church as an organization and church as a group of gathered people, to get back to this language, has been lost. That's the fundamental purpose.
You're looking at this through a Christian perspective. I mean, are you saying that anything that is of an ultimate concern to a person...
Would be their God talk. Yeah.
Okay, it doesn't have to be the true God.
That's why I would say why there's two sources of authority. One is our own experience, and one is the traditional theological biblical materials. I think you've got to test your own experience of what is meaningful and purposeful. It cannot stand by itself because of the limitations. I might say that killing other people is what's meaningful and purposeful to me, okay? But if I test that against the tradition and the biblical materials, my other source of authority doesn't wash. Okay?
What qualifies as ultimate concern then? Is it self-giving love? Is that...
I think that's what the biblical tradition would say.
So, okay, as a Christian, if my ultimate concern is not in self-giving love, I then am not... My God talk doesn't wash. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but self-giving love has many facets. I wouldn't want to try to tie that down, pin that down. If you, yeah, I would, given that qualification, I'd say yes.
So you're judging self-giving love.
Well, that's what the tradition establishes as the meaning and power of God.
What about an artist, let's say, who his gift or her gift is art, and it is a consuming 18-hour-a-day thing, and they spend their life painting as an expression of what's inside them.
That, again, that's a very good example of that. I sometimes use the one of Michelangelo, who on the one hand was consumed, had a consuming passion for his art. On the other hand, I think we can say two things about that. That can be an expression of God. If one is receiving God's love and responding with the expression of art, it seems to me that is an expression of self-giving love. On the other hand, there seems to be some good indications that for some people that becomes a very selfish, consuming kind of thing. And then in that case, if it's something that separates you from God, I don't care how good the art is, it still may be a source of sin. That which sin to me is, to use that word sin, is that which separates, holds apart, and art can be something that separates us with it from others and from God, as well as something that brings us back together. Again, the word sin, sometimes to get into that, I wasn't intending to go so quickly into the theological language, but the word sin so often is misinterpreted as a certain set of activities. If you do that, you're sinful. But a sin is seen as that which unifies or separates. Sin is that which separates, and the opposite of sin is what unifies or makes whole or one. Then the artist in the artist's creation can be sinful or not sinful, depending on how that creativity is received and responded to.
And I hear judgment in this, and I'm not sure that I could judge. So if I had two artists, I would not know, and it would be all right with me if it's right with them. I think in Jesus, I perceive these stories very childlike, that he really saw the prostitute as a person. He saw, you know, the rich person. He saw all kinds of individuals as people, and I think that's really...
I agree.
And so who's to judge about these two artists?
The point, though, that we're doing today is, as soon as Mary talks about sin, now we've got, now we're talking theology. Mm-hmm. And Bob is getting behind talking theology to how do you get to the point of using sin? First of all, you should know it's our talking. Theology is the way we talk about sin. Secondly, there has to be some experience out of which we're talking. There has to be some concern and ultimate values so that you can say sinful or good. And thirdly, the third premise is you have some experiences of what is morally right or sinful, but you test that with a book and with the experience of a community of people. In other words, it's the... We talk theologically, and
it's the think with, not the think about. No,
I'm not sure that distinction. What are you pointing to?
for you to say, Jesus, when he looked at the woman, accepted her as a person. Right. You are coming with some theological premises there. First of all, that Jesus is authoritative. All right. In your own experience of people, that, and it makes it hard to judge because there are two artists, and you simply don't want to say which one is, quote, good or bad. I don't know what word you use. All of that is theological thinking that has some basis to it. In your experience, and because you've seen Jesus dealing with a prostitute. I mean, those are all illustrations of three premises by which we all function one way or another.
And I would further say that finally that what you've experienced and expressed here is probably closer to what the words point to than your conceptions of what they mean as words. I just suggest
you see,
that.
I have a hard time dealing with the word sin.
Yeah, but
I find that very judgmental by some people. Mm-hmm. So a prostitute is bad. Well, I can say, I don't like what you do, but I like you.
Yeah, that's precisely the point.
I don't have to judge that person. I don't feel capable of doing that. Mm-hmm. So I can't really deal with sin as the thing. That's my problem.
Yeah, the word sin is that which separates people from human beings and God.
I only think of sin from the people in the church and people on the fish, you see.
Yeah. Oh, but other people outside the church are judging people all the time.
Oh, I know this. I think judgment is, I can deal with judgment, not sin. I don't know what sin is.
I see. Okay.
Well, sin is those activities which separate. So a prostitute, the reason why prostitution is frequently sinful is that it, in fact, if we look at our, the wisdom of the ages is that it frequently is an avenue of separation of peoples. You a dehumanized person in prostitution. That's why it's sinful so often. Now, is there a non-sinful prostitution? Well, I suspect someplace there is.
Well, see, you, what's prostitution for you?
Well, it's the selling of a woman and a male, man selling their bodies for money.
Well, to me, a prostitution is a prostitute. You see, it's like, what is the church to me? So I'm looking at prostitutes.
Well, it's a person who sells their body. And usually it's the turning of the body into an object again instead of a person that makes that sinful, if indeed that's what occurs in those activities. I don't want to say that all prostitutes are damned or something like that. Let's look at John 13. The Gospel according to John. It's on page 937 of your IRSV.
Here's some up here.
We got a whole bunch up here.
Yeah, okay.
Sure. I suppose one danger in trying to make a word like theology so approachable is that it loses any specific meaning, so that in listening to what you're saying, I'm not clear how you would distinguish God talk from what one thinks of as philosophy or humanism, for example.
That's another problem. It seems to me the greater problem for me right now is linking up with experience, the words. And if we could do that, then I would face this other problem, is what is God talk in our experience and what is not. And I think the clues, again, I would look for the clues to the answer to that question from the biblical traditional material. And what we were talking about before, preeminently at what is self-giving love, and clues to what that has in terms of content from the whole biblical traditional material. But that's how I would face that problem beyond what the one we're looking at is. And so we ask the question in our experience, what in it seems to partake of the same kind as that as we see in Jesus on the cross, for example, that epitome of self-givingness. What partakes of that kind of the meaning and purpose which is preeminently expressed there?
That's similar to my question, and I was wondering if by premise two you were trying to separate God talk from philosophical talk, or
I don't want to do that too soon, because I really think that God talk is talk about our human experience fundamentally. And if everyone would agree with me on that, I would be very happy at that point, and then I'd face that other problem, which seems to me to be secondary at this point.
But not everyone will, I'm sure.
On
Sunday mornings, almost every Sunday morning, listen to a sermon based on the tenet that the evil buzzwords are humanism, scholarship, reason, and
even everyday human experience is what I'm trying to point us to.
Fair enough, but I think it'd be hard to make that in a
I don't think the words will make sense to us until we make that connection. I really don't. And I think that we're doomed to a kind of peripheral existence until the church is seen, Christianity is seen, and talking about everyday human experience. However dangerous my assertion there is. Yes, excuse me.
I wrote a short, kind of a life,
it was part of a word witness exercise, kind of a life of Christ or Jesus' story. And I purposely didn't use any of the buzzwords. And it was fascinating because I was able to do it. And then I listened to the things that the other people wrote, and it was just like they quoted it from the Creed or something that had no meaning to me. But it was interesting because the group was rather divided, like maybe five of them liked what I'd written and seven didn't, you know. It's interesting.
I think I've got an experience like that in teaching. I will come with, many students will come having all the buzzwords down. And they'll come in for a conference and they'll start shooting buzzwords at me, and I'll say, can you say that without using any Christian vocabulary? And they become, it's very difficult for some of them. Some of them are very good at then immediately translating that into some sort of terms that don't use the buzzwords. But
I think that often using the words is maybe an excuse for understanding the concept.
Oh.
I mean, so.
Well, all we have to do is repeat the buzzwords and we've got the thing,
right,
the problem lit, without having to face the fact that the cross and the resurrection of Jesus Christ are pointing something that's a problem in us. We don't, as long as we use the buzzwords, we don't have to face the problem.
So in that sense, it's almost as if we're using this language as not what our ultimate reality is.
Sure.
It's the opposite of somehow.
So the biblical language and the theology can become sinful if we use sin as that which separates us. It seems to me, again. So,
right.
I'm sure that wasn't the intention of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but again, in our own methods of interpretation. Well, let's see if we can make sense of this biblical passage. As I've taken now 45 minutes to get into this. Who would like to read it? I would like to read from 13. Well, let's do it from 1 to 9. It goes on beyond 10. And let me say something. I'm not going to use this, try to exegete, there goes the buzzword, to understand this in the mind of what John was trying to say. I'm looking at the experience that's being portrayed here and some of the language used. But John has a specific theological purpose here in mind, and I'm not sure mine is the same as his. So let me admit that to start with, and then try. What I'm going to do is we'll read this, and then I want you to imagine yourself in the situation of having your feet washed, and then I'm going to really stop us, make us be quiet for a second. Then I'm going to ask you to shift your role and just try to feel what it would be like to do the washing of feet if you had to do that. I do the latter because I once did this at a retreat, and it was very difficult to do, and I discovered a new word about sin is that there's an inability to wash feet as well as to have your feet washed. Well, anyway. And then what I want to do is to take a few words, some of the words which you find most objectionable in the Christian buzzwords, and see if we can understand them in terms of what went on here, in terms of the experience, of an experience like washing feet. Who would like to read 13:1-9? Anybody? Go ahead. Thank you.
Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And during supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, and girded himself with a towel. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. He came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? Jesus answered him, What I am doing you do not know now, but afterwards you will understand. Peter said to him, You shall never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, If I do not wash you, you have no part in me. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head.
Okay. First exercise for a few moments. I'll try to keep it about a minute. Imagine yourself as Peter. what would you feel if Jesus, or you can imagine this in all kinds of different ways, if Mary Schramm walked in the door right now with a bucket of water and started taking off your shoes and washing your feet, what would be your sense, or what would you experience or feel? Let's just pause and imagine or think about that for a second, the possibility. Okay, now let's reverse the roles. You're Jesus or Mary Schramm. I'm not saying that they're very equal. They're putting Mary into a role that I think she can't hold. And you're the one that's got to be the one that's doing the washing of feet. How would you feel about washing someone's feet in the situation right now, this situation right here? Walk in the door with a bucket of water and start taking off people's shoes. How would you feel? Let's just pause a second and think about that. Okay. Now, we could go two ways. Is trying to just go straightly to the buzzwords and see how they seem to express what's going on here. On the other hand, let's talk about the experience. I think maybe that's the better place to start. What would you feel? What did you feel, or what would you feel if Mary Schramm or Jesus Christ walked through the door and started to wash your feet? Where was your imagination running? Some of you would probably have very different experiences here, but there's probably some commonality to them.
I am very self-conscious about my toes. I've always been. When I was young and we would go to the beach with a group of kids, I'd always make sure that my feet got buried in the sand and stayed there all day so that nobody would look at them. I just got a thing about the way my feet look.
So. The feet is one of the most lowly parts of the body. I can think of only a few others that are so lowly. We call them dogs. We malign them. We beat them to death on hikes, and we do very little to protect our feet. And they're a lowly part of the body. We don't call someone a dirty foot, but like we do some other parts of the body. But it's pretty down low on the list of human parts. Okay, some other people. I have the same experience. I don't know if I buried my feet in the sand.
I started to think, oh, well, I would like it because that's kind of a traditional response. But then I got thinking that I'd probably just take both my feet out. Because for the past month, I've been doing things and doing things and doing things, and I've been fantasizing sitting down and have somebody doing something for me. So it would probably fit into that, you know. In all honesty, as they go to it.
But the sense of being self-conscious about your feet would not be a problem.
No, I don't think so. Not if the person was determined to do it.
And determined, but would you, if you felt that person was manipulating you, you might not stick them out so quickly, would you? If you thought that it was care and love, you'd stick your feet out. But if it wasn't, you'd be a little hesitant.
If they, you know, yeah, right.
It's interesting. So would I.
Yeah, I could argue, I think, that in the context you're describing it, that the offer to act is what would appear to be a servant, in fact, be an aggressive act.
Could be.
I think if someone walked in and insisted on having you take off your shoes so they could wash your feet, that would be looked on as in fact an aggressive sort of response, and I suspect most people's backs would go up.
You've experienced people like that have a compulsiveness to serve you, and you're a little bit suspicious that there's something else besides service at the heart of their experience.
You know, it has always been suggested that one of the responses of inner city blacks to being in a white hospital situation is to exaggerate the role of a servant to, in fact, almost parody sort of a submissive.
As patients or as nurses or
no,
something?
Mostly as nurses' aides, people in the laundry, messengers, and so on.
And you have mixed up in there a long history of servility that God knows what's motivating that action.
Right, exactly.
Gee, that's interesting.
But I suppose the other side of that coin is that given the setting in John, the disciples all know who Jesus is.
Peter didn't. at that point.
So. I think so, didn't he, in John? I
mean, well, he says, don't wash my feet. Why did he say that? He says it, remember that it's about verse 8 or so. And Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet.
But he calls him Lord.
Yeah. Well, okay, but we can call people all kinds of names like that, but what's important isn't the words we use, but the what's going on. What does Lord mean in this situation? It means having your being allowing somebody to wash your feet, doesn't it? But Peter didn't, for at least his initial, and interestingly, Peter's initial response is, it says, don't wash my feet.
Yes, I heard that. Mm-hmm. Also, I feel that as he had more insight, he said, not only my feet, but other parts of me too.
That's an interesting term. I wonder what he's saying there.
I only expressed the word insight, meaning as I read that, yeah. He may have, I say may, had more insight into himself when he then asked not only for his feet.
But it could be, go ahead, Mary.
What are you reading into that?
Well, it could be that he's saying, get off your knees, Lord, if you're going to, don't wash just that. I mean, that's such a lowly thing. Don't be a lowly character like that, but wash all of me. Get to the most important part.
And that is your impression of getting off your knees. I did not say that.
I know you did. I said that's, and Mary asked me what I saw, and one of the possibilities is that, I'm suggesting. I don't know if that's what occurs there.
Well, you mean you just don't want to go back to the historical fact that every time you came into a meal, your feet were washed by a servant in the house, and I always assumed Jesus is taking this role.
Sure, servant role.
Okay.
And
but why? And wouldn't it be normal for if you called someone Lord, meaning you were giving your life to them and letting them lead you, that it would be very obvious that Peter wouldn't expect a man of that authority to.
Right.
To wash his feet.
So what, I don't understand.
But if we understand what the Christ is, that is the person who goes on the cross, who is the suffering servant, then we have to see him in the role of the washer of the feet. And Peter, at this point, at least doesn't seem to be perceiving that.
Perceiving what?
That Jesus is the suffering servant, and he's not... Yeah. And more important, if we can use a buzzword, which is faith, is a relationship of receiving and responding to the love which comes through other people. Peter, in this sense, is perceiving the washing of feet as an act which separates, not which unifies, makes whole, or puts us into relationship.
You see, I read this not as a matter of servant relationship.
You shall never wash my feet. And Jesus answered him, if I do not wash you, you have no part of me.
Right.
There's a sense in which the relationship between the person allowing him or herself to be washed and the washer as a giver of love has to be established before you can participate in the Christ. The Christ is that which establishes or that experience of having your feet washed. Or washing somebody's feet, or being open to do that.
But I can see how he's ignoring wash my feet. If he might have said, let me wash yours, but anyway, now, it was at that moment he was saying, no, not my feet. Then as Jesus responds, then he has another now. At that moment, he could...
Well, okay, but that may well be, but at least his initial response is the inability or the fear or the self-consciousness to not let his feet be washed. That is, there was separation, or in a sense, sin, if we want to use that word in its proper sense, of being something separate him. Peter probably being self-conscious, like Mary was, and like I am, by the way, or if I was doing the feet washing, the sense in which I, you know, it's kind of a scary act. You're very self-conscious in doing it. As long as that kind of self-experience of self-consciousness is in, self-centeredness is present in us, we probably are unable to participate in that relationship of foot washing, which is basically faith when that relationship is established. And we could look at a whole number of other words as it relates to that very kind of primal experience of foot washing.
We did that in the community last year once. At Maundy Thursday, one of the people that was here on the program had a learning disability, was not verbal at all. She came from a Quaker background, couldn't articulate, but she, what she did was have this foot washing ceremony. And it was the worst thing that had ever happened up here as far as the community was concerned. Maybe I'm just projecting my feelings.
And we did it again on Maundy Thursday. We chose to do it on Maundy Thursday. Dan Erlander designed it, and there were both the
That's right.
Both the officiating clergy and about four other people went around, and it was just, I mean, we had some trepidation about it being about people giggling or being uncomfortable or taking their sock off or do my feet smell. Just the opposite. It was just really powerful.
But the first time, it was just...
We talk about the power of God. You said it was really powerful, or the power of the Holy Spirit. It seems to me we have a really fresh example of what that power is right here. And the power of if we want to say the word Satan or the devil, is that is the power which makes us unable to either wash their feet or to have our feet washed. It's power. There's power there. There's power in self-giving love. It's power of a different kind than military might or something like that, but it's powerful. You want to comment?
Oh, yes. We attended the dedication of a young child in the Seventh-day Adventist Church about 2 months ago, and I don't know a lot about the church and other doctrines and so forth, but at, on that particular Sunday, they did have a foot-washing ceremony, and probably about 70 or 75% of the people there went to the lower part of the church. And initially I didn't know what was going on, and neither did my wife Susan, so we stayed up above, along with some other people who were members of the church and some others who were visitors attending the dedication. And when they were about halfway through the ceremony down below, we finally realized what was going on. Someone who had stayed above was telling us, and I was thinking about that. It struck me as such a novel idea, and I was wondering, because Sue and I came so close to going down and following down because of where we were situated in the church, and we saw some other friends of ours staying up above, so we decided to stay and talk to them. And I was wondering what we would have done had we gone down below and sat there and gone through the ceremony, which I guess we would have been welcome to do. And so it was interesting coming here this morning and being put in a position of thinking of what I would, how I would feel if Mary Schramm were washing my feet, or because I had gone through that before. And I was thinking how initially I would be so self-conscious about that, and I'd say, oh, maybe I should pretend like I have to go to the bathroom and I'll work my way back up. But there's the motivation behind doing that. It was interesting even that Sunday as we were sitting there and thinking about it. I would feel very self-conscious, not only for myself, but I guess for the person putting themselves in this humble position of washing the lowest part of your body. I'm a physician, and so all parts of the body are organically beautiful to me, but still, you know, the foot is still the lowest part of the body, and conceptually, you think about that. And here's this person humbling themselves enough to wash your feet, and it eventually struck Sue and I as we were talking about it, that it would be a beautiful way of putting yourself in harmony with this other person. If someone cares enough for you to be doing that, within a church setting or another setting, it struck us as potentially a very beautiful act. Now I don't know that everyone going down there, maybe it was part of the routine ceremony.
It could be routinized ceremony too. Yeah.
What do they do with women that wear pantyhose? I just said this.
I guess Susan asked that.
See, that was a problem of the modern age.
First of all, you come prepared.
I was going to say, after the first experience, you come prepared.
Yeah, you're going home with a wet pantyhose.
But if not, you do have time to. You're not rushed down there, you know. You would have time to go and change.
Yeah, John.
The thing that I thought of, Mary and I were on faculty here in 74, and so we had a living room and had some people that we had met over one evening. I don't really know how it started. I think it was unplanned, but people started talking about their dreams and hopes and goals, which is a kind of nice evening once in a while. If you haven't had somebody else to share and rebound, there were pastors who had hoped to do this. And one pastor's wife said, my dream is either my mother or my aunt or something, when she was older, I realized how much it meant to her to massage her feet. And my dream is to learn to really be a good foot massager and go to the local nursing homes and do for other people what I did. It was not romantic or kind of, and she's doing that now. I've been in touch with her husband since and asked him specifically about that dream. I will remember that as the finest dream I've ever heard, consistent with servanthood, because she was just so absolutely.
But it devastated everybody in the world.
Yeah, everybody else's dreams were.
Sure. that's the scandal of the cross, really, isn't it?
They were Christian dreams. They were always us doing something that was going to make it.
But when we talk about the scandal of the cross, there is a really good example of it. It's really scandalous.
But you see, the difference to me and Holden in the church.
This is part of the church.
You see, here, the bathrooms have to be done. Somehow they just got done. Beds have to be made, and somehow people made the beds. And you know, this is the difference. And the children, the family, and all this kind of thing is going on. And there is joy, there's allowing. There's very little judgment as I see it. Each one allows. And I think this is a neat community. That's my judgment. Do you think it fits for me better than a church? Some churches, I'm not talking about all churches. I just think that the washing of the feet is just a part of everyday things. At Finhorn, I have not been there, but I think if they thought someone very highly were coming, then you are assigned to the latrines, just simply to have to do every aspect of living. And there's something good about that, to have to deal with. Is one able to really do that instead of always being a star and always being something important? We're graded on that, you know. We're never graded on being.
Well, see, there's some insights which I to conclude this and use that as my entree for conclusion, is that I think the theological words are pointing to insights like that. And if we see the theological words out there, we're going to miss their importance, and we're going to have a conception of the church and of Christianity which is altogether different than what it's essentially what it's pointing to. And we can take almost any of the Christian words and apply them to the story and understand almost any of them in the sense of this washing of feet, just two or three lines, I would suggest.